Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
It's been another day chock full of headlines from the banking sector. Credit Suisse, Janet Yellen up on Capitol Hill. And then you've got, the nation's biggest banks here, certainly here in the United States, look to be close to a plan to deposit about $30 billion with First Republic Bank, which has been certainly under a lot of pressure. So let's get an update. Where are we? With us right now is Herman Chan. He's senior analyst for U.S. regional banks with our Bloomberg Intelligence team here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio, along with Shanali Bosak, Bloomberg News Wall Street reporter, who I'm convinced, because every time I listen to Bloomberg Radio or Bloomberg TV, she's there. So she's not getting any sleep. I'm sure Herman isn't either. Shanali, let's start with you, because I do feel like the headlines just kind of continue to come out. So where are we? Credit Suisse, First Republic, what do we need to know?
Let's talk about First Republic first, because we are expecting this afternoon an announcement, and it's in coordination with the big banks. We understand that these large banks have really brought forth this idea where each of them deposit, the biggest ones will deposit $5 billion each, the smaller ones will do less than that. It will be a package of, you know, nearly a dozen banks. And so it is a significant effort from the banking community to put money into First Republic, really stave off concerns in the banking system. And you are seeing First Republic stock, at least upon the initial news reports about this. Remember, all of this is still source material according to people familiar with the matter. No official announcement has been made. There's another interesting thing about the structure of this deal that if you're a stock or bond holder, you would like, and it's that by infusing this bank with deposits, you're not necessarily eroding the equity or debt. And so it's a way to kind of find a solution that is approved by the government that falls short of a sale.
Right, certainly better than trying to do an equity offering in this environment, I think, which is sort of what undid SVB. But, you know, Shanali, I look at the KRX, the regional bank index, and I see PacWest Bancorp down 52% year to date, Bank of Hawaii down 32%, more than 10 bank stocks in that index down 20-some percent this year. Is this going to be a rolling crisis, do you think, where they just go from bank to bank to bank that are looking the weakest in the market?
Well, we should probably ask Herman, right?
Well, yeah, especially because me and him were researching the parallels between the S&L crisis, which is what everybody has been bringing up. Fewer banks failed, but larger banks are failing.
Larger banks are failing. Signature and SVB were larger banks that failed. What I would say is that You mentioned PacWest. There's others like Western Alliance that are sort of caught up in this vortex. I would say that the decisive action and the
Which was it UBS that yesterday, or somebody came out and said Western Alliance was their top pick?
Exactly. So the unique partnership with the government and the private banks is essentially putting a line in the sand and saying that SVB happens, Signature happens. We're going to try to prop up First Republic, putting our own money at stake into the depository institution so the rest of the depositors at FRC, First Republic, can sleep well at night.
How does this happen, though, Shanali? Because what happens if there's another one? Do the
does the private banking industry come in and help out? Like, it's, you know, I was just surprised.
You could ask the same thing of what happened Sunday night with the FDIC backstop. You're hearing today Treasury Secretary Yellen kind of telling you that if it's a systemically important bank, your deposits are safe. I'm really curious about what Herman thinks of that as well, because, you know, anybody who was watching the market and the reason there are still fears under the market is there was at no point that the government said we are going to save the depositors of every bank should we have a rolling issue here. And by the way, it's funny because I'm answering an email from one of our clients. They're like, why First Republic and not all the others when you're looking at this deposit infusion?
Lehman probably was asking that in the great financial crisis as well, right?
I think it's a great question because First Republic, remember, this is something that was a very healthy acquisition target for a while, but it's not easy for a large bank to buy another bank. There are limits, deposit caps. There's all sorts of other issues when they're buying a bank. And basically, they just kind of want security from the government that if they were to buy something, it would be okay. But right now, this is not a bank that is easy to buy by any fashion.
And I would say to that effect with First Republic, it's not a bank that ran into issues when rates were low and then subsequently are high now. You compare that with SVB, and they had a very large $15 billion loss position in their securities portfolio. And for Signature, they were very much involved with the crypto business. So two very important issues that FRC, First Republic, just doesn't have.
That's what I was asking. What's the connective tissue? But it's different cases, and we kind of keep pointing. Like Credit Suisse, different from SVB, right? Different from Signature. So I don't know how to read.
There are commonalities. Is there? I think the one of them being that a lot of smaller firms were always going to be under stress, given, you know, their bond portfolios, okay, given the deposit issues they had. I mean, we knew this was going to be a problem. We knew this for months. We didn't know that it was going to be this much of a problem. And the depositor flight at Silicon Valley, they had a much more concentrated depositor base. First Republic has wealthier clients by and large. They also have a very attractive loan book to a lot of banks as well. So again, they're fine-ish.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they're still getting a $30 billion deposit infusion. So it's a difficult situation. Herman, another question I have for you is, you know, To Mike's point here. Sorry, McKee and I have been emailing all day.
We all look alike, us, Mike.
No. He's just in my mind because he's a central bank to my banks. But, you know, what about PacWest and Western Alliance?
I think it's just more of an implicit vote of confidence for the overall industry. If the government and the private, you know, publicly traded banks will come together to save one of their institutions. And I would also like contrast with what happened with SVB and the VC community, where they abandoned their own personal bank, whereas these, you know, the peers of First Republic are banding together to save them. So it's an interesting contrast.
But with pressure, can we assume there was pressure from regulators?
I think that's a safe assumption. Well,
it's an interesting thing because from what we understand, it wasn't just the regulators that are wanting this for First Republic. It's the banks as well. First Republic, usually what you're seeing when you look at these institutions, they try to hire boutiques or kind of independent banks. Silicon Valley Bank had hired Centerview, for example. But for a while, First Republic had been working with JP Morgan.
Okay.
And after that Signature Bank, you know, mm-hmm, announcement we had on Sunday after they were taken over by regulators, they said they secured additional liquidity from the Fed and from JP Morgan. So the tide to First Republic for the biggest banks are a little larger. Now Silicon Valley Bank is another good example because it's trying to go through this process where they're selling assets and they're hitting so many snags.
Yeah.
And so it was more marginalized this bank.
Do we know where this ends yet?
No. How can
it's
we?
It's really hard to say at this point.
We don't.
There could be some more twists and turns, but I think today's action really should be seen as a vote of confidence.
But Herman, you know what I wonder is this crisis is so unique because typically a banking crisis is triggered by poor quality credit,
you know,
whether it's mortgage delinquencies, whatever on the credit side. I wonder if that shoe perhaps is yet to drop for the banking sector. You know, is there the chance with this blistering campaign to raise hikes that in a few weeks, months, however long, we're going to start hearing about credit issues,
right,
and have another sort of round of hair pulling over the banks?
Well, we just heard about Richard Clarida's comments earlier about a hard landing. I think what you've seen over the past week or so is that the regional banks are going to contract lending because they are really concerned about their deposits, with deposits exiting their balance sheets. So they don't have sort of like the dry powder to lend because in essence, your deposits fuels future lending. And if those deposits are leaving, then the lending capacity is diminished, and that could hurt the overall economy.
All right, we need to talk about Credit Suisse. Mm-hmm. What do we need to know about that? Which has been, we've talked about this already. They've had problems for a while, and they've been trying to kind of right the ship, if you will.
I think one positive sign from Credit Suisse is what, remember, yesterday was a lot of panic. Mm-hmm. But even within the panic, I was kind of trying to take a couple meetings out of the office to go into different offices to see how folks were feeling. And what they were saying is, listen, Credit Suisse has been in problems for a long time. Many people have reduced risk for a very long time as far as counterparty risk and other kind of, you know, lending arrangements and whatnot. But the general sense was, listen, it's still a globally systemic financial institution. The Swiss government stepped up at the end of the day. The problem, if a SIFI were to fail, the problem for Wall Street, its investors, everybody else, fewer options are not a good thing. When it comes to the banking system, we've learned, you have to diversify mm-hmm. where you keep your money. That is certainly true for large institutions. Corporations have learned it the hard way with Silicon Valley Bank.
Right.
And, you know, even for individual depositors, diversifying is how the system works.
All right, real quickly, 5 seconds each of you. What are you keeping on your radar right now?
Deposits is the name of the game.
Anything else hitting into a problem? I mean, honestly, every day is like you wake up.
Is that the bucket?
Shanali's radar is like 8 feet wide. It's got everything on it.
No. Yeah, you never know. Listen, look at the market moves every single day.
I know. Different.
One day is bad. It's tough out there.
Yeah, which is, I think, very telling in its own right, which means it's a little bit trickier, I think, for Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell when they meet next week. Thank you. This is how we like to do a setup. Herman Chan, senior analyst for U.S. regional banks, with our Bloomberg intelligence team and the woman who never sleeps, Shanali Basak, our Bloomberg News Wall Street reporter. I want what she's having. How do you keep sleep?
Just 2 cups of coffee today.
I'm sure there's more. All right. Carol Masser, Mike Regan, you are listening and watching Bloomberg Radio.
Attention campers. The new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We want to get to another name that was rallying in today's session following their latest quarterly update earlier this morning. We're talking about Lands' End, which is a great check in terms of what's going on in retail and the consumer. The company's first quarter net revenue forecast beating estimates, helping to send the small cap stock rallying around 18% today. So let's get to it. We have the company's CEO, Andrew McLean. He is with us on Zoom in Wisconsin. Andrew, nice to have you back with us here on Bloomberg. A lot going on. Sorry, just trying to keep up here. How do you feel about the environment right now?
You know, I feel pretty good about the environment. We look at our customer like in some detail. We've got 7 million of them, so we got a lot of data to work with. We're seeing that they're relatively robust right now. They're sort of weathering inflation. They're weathering the political environment. They're weathering the banking issues that we're seeing over the last week or so. So no particular cracks yet, and a little bit of momentum, if anything.
Well, Andrew, let's get into that idea of the inflation. What are you seeing in your sort of supply chain? Is there any hope that this inflation, especially that cost input that you're dealing with, is there any hope there that we've seen the worst of it or what? What are we looking at?
I mean, I certainly hope so. I mean, you know, we've definitely seen transportation costs become more favorable to us than they were last year, and hopefully we'll pick that up as a tailwind for us this year. Some of the prices of fabrics have moderated as well, and you know, we're working with our factories closely to make sure that, you know, we see those costs passed on. But, you know, we're chipping away at it every day. I think everyone's trying to hang on to, you know, the extra dollars that they made during the pandemic, and you just have to fight your corner.
Is it easier to be a CEO today versus where it was 12 months ago?
I think so. I think it was more looking at uncertainty 12 months ago. I actually felt, and I said this at one of the conferences earlier this year, I felt that retail went through its recession sort of late Q3, early Q4. I think the sector was in recession, whether the country was or not. You know, it's up for debate. But I'm hoping, I'm touching wood here, that the worst is past us, and we can look forward to set ourselves out for a decent year.
Having said that, you know, we talk about customers trading down or looking for bargains. Are you seeing any signs of kind of some of the patterns in terms of how customers and consumers are shopping that tells you a little bit more about the economic outlook?
I have an 18-year life on my customers. I mean, they come to us and they stay forever. And so we get a good read on them through various life stages. You know, what we're starting to see, if anything, is, well, actually, it's a continuation of a theme. We're leaning in more and more to leisure and vacation. You know, I've talked a lot today on various calls about swim. And, you know, we've continued to power ourselves from late December through to mid-March off the back of swim and really building out the vacation outfit for our customer. And I can tell you, she's really embracing it. And, you know, we see that at a number of cohorts. We sell a lot of school uniforms, and mm-hmm. we make connections with late millennial moms, and, you know, they're buying our swim. You know, she's thinking very much about vacation this year.
Yeah, Andrew, how are you thinking about sort of the sales channels these days? Is the retail physical stores, are they back? Is that the focus going forward? Or do you still have sort of the online hangover from the pandemic?
I think there's a place for physical stores in any retailer. I've worked for a lot of retailers that had physical stores. For Land's End, we have a different physical manifestation of our brand, and it's through a catalog. We only have 30 stores. It's, you know, we reported they're relatively small revenue for us in the scheme of how we approach the world. For us, it's about our digital ecosystem, and, you know, we have two businesses, a B2B business and a B2C business in the digital world, and they're both scalable and profitable. And, you know, that's what we're leaning into, and the physical manifestation of the brand that supports them, kind of gives us that mid and upper funnel marketing is really our catalog.
Yeah, I think when you've been on in the past, I've definitely bought a school uniform from you in the past. Remind our audience, though, and forgive me for not remembering, but your B2B or your, you know, the school uniforms and the uniforms that you provide for hospitality and leisure, that is how much of your business?
So that Outfitters business, which comprises three things, is this: those the very large customers, you know, like an American Airlines. There's small, medium businesses in there, you know, auto parts companies, hotel chains. And then we're into school uniforms, and those three businesses together comprise 16-17% of our total revenue base.
Andrew, how is this high interest rate environment affecting you? I mean, I assume it must be a headwind to some degree. Is it a huge challenge? Are you able to refinance in this environment? I assume not.
You know, we talked about it on the call this morning. It's like you definitely saw our interest charges ticking up. That was partly driven by the inventory receipts that we had last year. It was also driven by rising interest rates. And, you know, we found ourselves in a situation where we had to place debt in the pandemic and then had a two-year no-call on it, which left us shut out by the time we got around to trying to get back into the markets again. And we're going to come back to the markets as soon as they open up. And replace that debt, and that's one of our priorities for us. But there's things we're doing to mitigate that. You know, we're landing our inventory much more differently. You know, we're not holding as much of it. We're going to increase. Well, we are increasing the returns in our business, and the reality is we'll chip away at that side of it as well. I think the question would be, is how's the consumer doing with it? And it's like, you know, she's taking it in her stride.
What does that mean? What does in her stride mean?
Well, you know, it's just, I think she's probably finding ways to cut corners, but there are certain go-tos that she wants. So if I look at my business, my best ats, or I've got a handful of best ats, and you know, one of those is swim, one of those is outerwear, one of those is the fit of our product, particularly the bottoms, and we see her leaning into those categories. You know, it's like she's still very much inclined to take those on. And if I compare that with my business in Europe, you know, it's been a little tougher with the business in Europe because, you know, once we got into the war with Ukraine in Europe, we saw the business really sort of like back down, and we felt that resistance for most of the last year.
Yeah, Andrew, I wonder what sort of keeps you up at night as the biggest risk. I mean, my guess is this labor market has proven to be so strong. The consumer still remains strong. Is that the main risk, do you think, just a creep higher in the unemployment rate and sort of less confidence among consumers? Is that a risk this year?
Yes, it is. I mean, you know, but I have this amazing trove of data. Trove's a funny word, but I've been using it a lot today. I have this trove of data, and it's like, I'm looking at my customer, and you know, there's definitely a customer in there who is feeling the interest rates. But you know, again, she's switching, as I talked about, to product categories that really work for her, and I can see the energy through the first quarter. I mean, I'm now past the midpoint of the first quarter, so I can see the energy of where she's at in the first quarter. That'll carry through to the second quarter, but you know, some sort of system shock to that, and you know, it's harder to see for the back half of the year.
Hey, one last question, Andrew, if I may, and we just got about 30 seconds. I mean, in an environment where we are so focused on what's going on in the banking community right now, and we've seen it create some stress, certainly in financial markets, how do you factor that in at all in terms of your job? And again, just got about 20 seconds.
I'm just going to make sure that it's like that we're appropriately financed, we have access to the capital we need, and then I'm going to just tell you that customers, I'm not experiencing it through my customer right now. She's not said, I see a crisis, I'm going to react differently. She's trucked on right through that, and I hope that continues.
All right. Well, really good to get your perspective. Really appreciate it. Andrew McLean, he's Chief Executive Officer at Lands.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We want to get to another name that was rallying in today's session following their latest quarterly update earlier this morning. We're talking about Land's End, which is a great check in terms of what's going on in retail and the consumer. The company's first quarter net revenue forecast beating estimates, helping to send the small cap stock rallying around 18% today. So let's get to it. We have the company's CEO, Andrew McLean. He is with us on Zoom in Wisconsin. Andrew, nice to have you back with us here on Bloomberg. A lot going on. Sorry, just trying to keep up here. How do you feel about the environment right now?
You know, I feel pretty good about the environment. We look at our customer like in some detail. We've got 7 million of them, so we got a lot of data to work with. We're seeing that they're relatively robust right now. They're sort of weathering inflation. They're weathering the political environment. They're weathering the banking issues that we're seeing over the last week or so. So no particular cracks yet. And a little bit of momentum, if anything.
Well, Andrew, let's get into that idea of the inflation. What are you seeing in your sort of supply chain? Is there any hope that this inflation, especially that cost input that you're dealing with, is there any hope there that we've seen the worst of it or what? What are we looking at?
I mean, I certainly hope so. I mean, you know, we've definitely seen transportation costs become more favorable to us than they were last year. And hopefully we'll pick that up as a tailwind for us this year. Some of the prices of fabrics have moderated as well. And you know, we're working with our factories closely to make sure that, you know, we see those costs passed on. But, you know, we're chipping away at it every day. I think everyone's trying to hang on to, you know, the extra dollars that they made during the pandemic. And you just have to fight your corner.
Is it easier to be a CEO today versus where it was 12 months ago?
I think so. I think it was more looking at uncertainty 12 months ago. I actually felt, and I said this at one of the conferences earlier this year, I felt that retail went through its recession, sort of late Q3, early Q4. I think the sector was in recession, whether the country was or not. You know, it's up for debate. But I'm hoping, I'm touching wood here, that the worst is past us, and we can look forward to set ourselves out for a decent year.
Having said that, you know, we talk about customers trading down or looking for bargains. Are you seeing any signs of kind of some of the patterns in terms of how customers and consumers are shopping that tells you a little bit more about the economic outlook?
I have an 18-year life on my customers. I mean, they come to us and they stay forever. And so we get a good read on them through various life stages. You know, what we're starting to see, if anything, is, well, actually, it's a continuation of a theme. We're leaning in more and more to leisure and vacation. You know, I've talked a lot today on various calls about swim. And, you know, we've continued to power ourselves from late December through to mid-March off the back of swim and really building out the vacation outfit for our customer. And I can tell you, she's really embracing it. And, you know, we see that at a number of cohorts. We sell a lot of school uniforms, and mm-hmm. we make connections with millennial, late millennial moms, and, you know, they're buying our swim. You know, she's thinking very much about vacation this year.
Yeah, Andrew, how are you thinking about sort of the sales channels these days? Is the retail physical stores, are they back? Is that the focus going forward? Or do you still have sort of the online hangover from the pandemic?
I think there's a place for physical stores in any retailer. I've worked for a lot of retailers that had physical stores. For Land's End, we have a different physical manifestation of our brand, and it's through a catalog. We only have 30 stores. It's, you know, we reported they're relatively small revenue for us in the scheme of how we approach the world. For us, it's about our digital ecosystem, and, you know, we have two businesses, a B2B business and a B2C business in the digital world, and they're both scalable and profitable. And, you know, that's what we're leaning into, and the physical manifestation of the brand that supports them, kind of gives us that mid and upper funnel marketing is really our catalog.
Yeah, I think when you've been on in the past, I've definitely bought a school uniform from you in the past. Remind our audience, though, and forgive me for not remembering, but your B2B or your, you know, the school uniforms and the uniforms that you provide for hospitality and leisure, that is how much of your business?
So that Outfitters business, which comprises three things, is this: those the very large customers, you know, like an American Airlines. There's small, medium businesses in there, you know, auto parts companies, hotel chains. And then we're into school uniforms, and those three businesses together comprise 16-17% of our total revenue base.
Andrew, how is this high interest rate environment affecting you? I mean, I assume it must be a headwind to some degree. Is it a huge challenge? Are you able to refinance in this environment? I assume not.
You know, we talked about it on the call this morning. It's like you definitely saw our interest charges ticking up. That was partly driven by the inventory receipts that we had last year. It was also driven by rising interest rates. And, you know, we found ourselves in a situation where we had to place debt in the pandemic and then had a two-year no-call on it, which left us shut out by the time we got around to trying to get back into the markets again. And we're going to come back to the markets as soon as they open up. And that debt, and that's one of our priorities for us. But there's things we're doing to mitigate that. You know, we're landing our inventory much more differently. You know, we're not holding as much of it. We're going to increase. Well, we are increasing the turns in our business, and the reality is we'll chip away at that side of it as well. I think the question would be: is how's the consumer doing with it? And it's like, you know, she's taking it in her stride.
What does that mean? What does inner stride mean?
Well, you know, it's just, I think she's probably finding ways to cut corners, but there are certain go-tos that she wants. So if I look at my business, my best ats, or I've got a handful of best ats, and you know, one of those is swim, one of those is outerwear, one of those is the fit of our product, particularly the bottoms, and we see her leaning into those categories. You know, it's like she's still very much inclined to take those on. And if I compare that with my business in Europe, you know, it's been a little tougher with the business in Europe because, you know, once we got into the war with Ukraine in Europe, we saw the business really sort of like back down, and we felt that resistance for most of the last year.
Yeah, Andrew, I wonder what sort of keeps you up at night as the biggest risk. I mean, my guess is this labor market has proven to be so strong. The consumer still remains strong. Is that the main risk, do you think, just a creep higher in the unemployment rate and sort of less confidence among consumers? Is that a risk this year?
Yes, it is. I mean, you know, but I have this amazing trove of data. Trove's a funny word, but I've been using it a lot today. I have this trove of data, and it's like I'm looking at my customer, and you know, there's definitely a customer in there who is feeling the interest rates. But you know, again, she's switching, as I talked about, to product categories that really work for her, and I can see the energy through the first quarter. I mean, I'm now past the midpoint of the first quarter, so I can see the energy of where she's at in the first quarter. That'll carry through to the second quarter, but you know, some sort of system shock to that, and you know, it's harder to see for the back half of the year.
Hey, one last question, Andrew, if I may, and we just got about 30 seconds. I mean, in an environment where we are so focused on what's going on in the banking community right now, and we've seen it create some stress, certainly in financial markets, how do you factor that in at all in terms of your job? And again, just got about 20 seconds.
I'm just going to make sure that it's like that we're appropriately financed, we have access to the capital we need, and then I'm going to just tell you that customers, I'm not experiencing it through my customer right now. She's not said, I see a crisis, I'm going to react differently. She's trucked on right through that, and I hope that continues.
All right. Well, really good to get your perspective. Really appreciate it. Andrew McLean, he's Chief Executive Officer at Lands End.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, with so much going on in the world, it's unfortunately easy to forget that Turkey continues to struggle following the February 6th earthquakes that killed over 50,000 people in Turkey and Syria. And if you add on top of that some flooding on Wednesday from torrential rains in Turkey's southeast, that killed at least 15 people. I mean, Mike, the natural disasters have created a host of problems and health issues. So we felt like we wanted to get some thoughts on that. And with us is Dr. Paul Spiegel. He's director of the Center for Humanitarian Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Spiegel via Zoom in Baltimore. Dr. Spiegel, nice to have you here on Bloomberg. The earthquake devastated infrastructure on so many different levels, and we know that makes it ripe for dangerous health situations. Throw on top, certainly in Turkey, some of the flooding. What are you hearing specifically?
Thank you, Carol. Yes, the situation is and remains dire, even if it's not being reported on. What I'm hearing and seeing with my colleagues and friends in the field is that there are two different situations in many ways. You have the situation in Turkey where people remain often in makeshift settlements, living in cars because so many of their homes and the apartments have been destroyed. Where you have in northwest Syria, which has already been a humanitarian crisis for nearly 11 years now, with over 4 million people on humanitarian assistance, still insufficient aid getting there. There was already a cholera outbreak, which has worsened. And so the situation remains dire, and sadly, despite perhaps not the same media attention, will remain dire for likely years. And it's very, very concerning.
Doctor, I was wondering if you could just talk about what role the Hopkins Center for Humanitarian Health plays in a crisis like this. Is it as an advisory type of role, or is it actually providing doctors on the ground or coordination? When a crisis hits, what's sort of the first order of business for you?
Right. So, I mean, Hopkins, the Center for Humanitarian Health, is not an NGO. And so generally, we don't provide aid as an NGO would. What we do is we work with people on the ground and looking at the public health situation. So we will and have been supporting with technical responses in terms of surveillance. And we did actually have some people on the ground at the time that the earthquake occurred, unfortunately, and they were able to provide some assistance. But for the most part, what we're doing is trying to examine the situation and then provide technical response, as well as we continue to provide trainings both now and in the future, so that the future humanitarians that will actually be providing hands-on experience have the latest evidence, the latest data to respond.
Well, and you did serve as the emergency coordinator for the WHO's Ukraine refugee response last year. I mean, as you look at this crisis, how does it compare?
Yeah. So for that, because of my background, I actually do respond sometimes as a, with WHO or mm-hmm. with UNICEF and others. And so in this situation, in many ways, you would imagine it would be very, very different because you had an acute onset earthquake in Turkey and in northwest Syria compared to an acute conflict with Russia invading Ukraine. But in fact, there sadly are many similarities. Both were predictable. It was not possible to know when the earthquake was going to hit, but clearly the earthquake was going to hit. And so preparedness, and much better preparedness, was possible. Similarly, we knew that through intelligence that the Russians were on the border for a long period of time, yet Ukraine and the surrounding European countries were insufficiently prepared. But then things change because you see how in Europe, with the resilience and the strong health systems, how they were able to deal with millions of people flooding in to their countries. And we have not seen the increase. I mean, of course, there has been some exacerbation of existing illnesses, but certainly not the deaths and certainly not the increase in morbidity that we're seeing in northwest Syria and in Turkey.
Doctor, it's obviously hard to make a building that's invulnerable to a major earthquake, but I have read that building codes in this region were an issue with this specific one in perhaps exacerbating the injuries and the deaths. Is that true? Are building codes an important part of the story?
Yeah, very important. I mean, I think we sometimes building codes seem not tangible, but we should think of building codes like a helmet or a seat belt, where if you don't wear those and if you don't implement and have inspections of building codes, buildings will fall down. And this is when you look at, for example, some of the building codes in Western United States or in Japan, they're very strong and they're enforced. And the earthquakes that happened there are not nearly as, even if they're of a significant magnitude, the results are not nearly as bad as what happened in Turkey. And in Turkey, everyone knew that the building codes were not being enforced, and bizarrely, they even had the possibility of paying a fine so that you were able not to follow the building codes, because when you follow building codes properly, it is more expensive. And there was this push towards economic boom in infrastructure, and then building codes were not followed, and so we see this is preventable. And I would add that the same issue is occurring in Istanbul, and in terms of not following building codes. And Istanbul is much more packed than many of these other cities in Turkey, and has previously had massive earthquakes. And so Turkey's going to need to do a significant amount of retrofitting, which is more expensive, to make these buildings more earthquake proof.
As you say, though, this is a situation that's going to be dealt with for years, and certainly the rebuild is going to take a long term. What are the longer term health implications as a result?
Yeah, well, we're already seeing, but I guess these are more short terms in terms of diarrhea, watery diarrhea, increase in diarrhea. The longer term implications are, there are many people that have had serious injuries, broken bones, crush injuries. There's going to need to be physiotherapy and rehabilitation. We're also going to be seeing people that are not able to get the care and or are not prioritizing that care because they've lost everything else. And so issues will see increases in consequences of not taking care of diabetes and hypertension. And furthermore, one of the most difficult areas will be mental health. I mean, I've been speaking with people on the ground just today, two people, and not just the people, of course, that have been affected by the earthquake, but the caregivers themselves are not prepared for what they've seen. And what is even more difficult, I think, is you have caregivers that are there on the ground who have also suffered. And so they haven't just, they're not just responding to a crisis, but they're being affected. And so mental health remains a problem.
Extreme stress, and I can only imagine, in terms of mental wellness. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it, and important to keep this on everybody's radar. Dr. Paul Spiegel, Director of the Center for Humanitarian Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, so, yeah, we're trying to figure out if the walls are coming tumbling down here. You know, we've heard a lot of conversations that this isn't another banking crisis, but let's get to the cover story of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's a new double issue. It's available on newsstands, bloomberg.com/businessweek, always on the Bloomberg terminal. It's a finance section takeover. It could not be more timely. It is about the sudden unmaking of Silicon Valley Bank, which for 40 years really enmeshed itself in the venture capital community. So let's get to it. Lots of facets to this story. So with us is Bloomberg Markets finance editor of Businessweek magazine, Pat Regnier. He's in our studio, along with editor-at-large Eric Schatzker and the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber. And we're going to start with you, Joel. This is a story. We continue to track some headlines on the Bloomberg about the banking community overall. How did you and your editors and your team kind of figure out how to actually cover it and put it to bed, at least for this week?
This was such a significant story, and it broke at really a crazy time for us because, of course, it also Silicon Valley Bank not alone in this. Three U.S. banks in 1 week was significant. Obviously, of those three, Silicon Valley was the biggest, and that's why we wanted to really kind of like make sure that we looked at that, because there's a greater meaning to this bank. It relates to obviously Silicon Valley, venture capital, private equity, and interest rates. And so, you know, I think we spent 10 years talking about the financial crisis, if not longer. This at the moment doesn't look like it's going to become quite like that. But, you know, on its balance sheet, Silicon Valley had, as Eric writes, a strategy that you could call into question now. And that has raised a lot of eyebrows. And it's meant to me that, you know, we might not be through all of this yet. And so I wanted to make sure that in the magazine, we flagged that in a big way. And Pat was the architect that kind of, I mean, frankly, he hit this structure where it was like, we want to talk about Silicon Valley Bank. We want to talk about what happened in DC, which we also had as part of that package. And then Eric put a bow on it just to say, like, you know, there's a greater meaning here that is about the financialization of everything. And so we'll talk about probably all those three themes here. Pat, what was the thing that really stood out to you in this package of coverage in the magazine?
One of the things that I really wanted to convey was how crazy the weekend felt. I was sitting in a diner in Brooklyn and looking at my Twitter feed and watching not just the aftermath of a bank failure, but a very loud bank failure. This was probably one of the loudest failures of a regional bank that we've ever had. You could see the VC community sort of raising alarms, I think in some ways on purpose. It created a scary weekend, even though I think probably, there was reason to think all along that this was not going to be allowed to get too far. People seem to understand it, but that anxiety that we came in on Monday morning really said that, you know, it just had to talk about something important has changed here, that we could have a moment like this.
Well, and I think what's fascinating about this story, it's not like this was a household name in the banking community, SVB. Now it is. Yeah. But Pat, I feel like that was a big part of telling this story of like, who is this bank? Right. And why are we all so stressed out?
Right. Well, obviously, it wasn't an unfamiliar name if you were in the Valley. And so like one of the stories we wanted to tell was we have Ellen Hewitt, who's our reporter in the Valley, talking about just like how essential this was to sort of the way just day-to-day life worked for people in the startup community. And she said it was like waking up to a hellfire in your very own living room. Like mm-hmm. what's suddenly on fire here? That dynamic was really powerful because it was all the same kinds of clients at all the same bank, all talking to each other, and with a lot of cash. We've talked a lot about the fact that like there was something happening on the asset side of their balance sheet, but the mm-hmm. other thing that was happening was what was going on the liability side of their balance sheet, which was they had people who suddenly woke up to realize that they had reason to be nervous. Which is not usually the case with most banks. Most banks, half of your money, like you know, it wouldn't matter what you did on your asset side. They don't need to run to the bank. They're insured. That money's insured. This was a very different situation.
Yeah, Eric, I want to bring you in a little bit here because I love the headline on your column on this issue: arrogance, incompetence, or both. What SVB's failure really means, and I think. You know, it's interesting whenever we have a failure like this, the question often is, well, was this an incompetence or was there actual sort of criminal behavior here? It doesn't seem like that with SVB, but I mean, can incompetence be so great that it sort of crosses the threshold into criminality?
Incompetence is probably the best explanation for one half of what happened to SVB. And arrogance is probably the best explanation for the other half of what happened to SVB. Incompetence applies to the asset side of the balance sheet. The fact that they mismanaged duration risk is unconscionable for any banker, certainly a bank of SVB's size. It was the 16th largest bank in the country. The arrogance, though, applies to the liability side of the balance sheet. And what we mean by that is the fact that they clearly, not just SVB, the they is bigger than SVB and its management, it also applies to the bank regulators, the collective they failed to recognize or appreciate that there was a different kind of concentration risk at the bank, and it had to do with the nature of the bank's deposits. Over the course of some 20 years, SVB, changed from being a bank that really did focus on the innovation economy, the startups in the Valley, in tech, in life sciences, medical devices, biotechnology, and became a bank that principally served the VC and private equity communities. And those ended up being massive depositors at SVB. And we know now that Founder Collective, Coatu Management, Founders Fund, Peter Thiel's fund, all in a heartbeat withdrew those deposits and ordered their portfolio companies to do the same. That wouldn't happen, for example, at a Fifth Third Bancorp. That's the next largest bank after Silicon Valley Bank. It has 6.17 million individual accounts that fall under the $250,000 cap for Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation insurance. That means all of those 6.17 million accounts effectively were protected. And at Silicon Valley Bank, that number was it was only equivalent to 6% of their deposits. Wow. Pat likes to talk about hot deposits. You will not find hotter deposits than the deposits that were and no longer are at Silicon Valley Bank.
Jill, come on back in.
Okay, so Erica, you, I think we're just a guiding presence in a lot of just what we are thinking about in this package, actually. And I do want to, you know, make sure that we spin this forward a little bit and think about what this could mean going forward. I mean, obviously this interest rate thing that SVB got really wrong. Is it a question at this point of like, you know, SVB did it wrong, but like who else didn't? And you know, this lag that we've talked about a little bit before with interest rates, how else are you kind of just thinking about where else this could show up in the financial ecosystem?
Well, I was already thinking about First Republic. Yeah. And just to revisit a few of the headlines of the past hour. It just got $30 billion of deposits from a number of big banks, including Bank of America and JP Morgan. So yes, that was a problem. And there may be other regional banks that similarly mismanage their interest rate risk. We don't know all of the details. It's very important to say that because some of these banks actually are smart and do hedge. Some of that interest rate exposure didn't happen at Silicon Valley Bank. Quite probable that it didn't happen elsewhere as well. But beyond the quality of the asset side of the balance sheet, there are other things to think about that we've been talking about and which undoubtedly we will end up covering here at Bloomberg in many different ways. The second, third, fourth, and fifth order effects, like corporate treasurers asking themselves, do I really want to have money in deposit accounts any longer? Why shouldn't I take the excess cash that I've got and sweep it into a money market fund? It'll earn a higher yield to begin with, and it will be protected because if it's a money market fund that's invested in treasuries and agencies, it has the backing of the U.S. government. This is not, I mean, these things are going to play out over the next weeks, months, quarters, possibly years, and it might not be a serious issue in the short run because there are so many federal facilities now in place to backstop the banking system, but these changes will happen. They will take place. They will transform the American banking landscape. I wouldn't be surprised if maybe even as little as 18 months from now, things look vastly different.
What I want to, and Pat, I want to bring you back in here because I do think about this perfect storm of, think about in a year what has happened with the interest rate environment. That's one thing to think about. Also, the role of social media in creating a velocity, certainly with SVB. And then you've got, in what Eric writes about, this financialization of our world and increasingly the role of private markets that don't necessarily have the transparency. You put that together and you're like, well, of course we're going to have some problems.
Yeah, you know, after we closed this issue, I called my dad. My dad worked in the savings and loan industry during the savings and loan crisis, and he ended up working for the Resolution Trust Corporation, which was the government agency that did the bailout. So he called me and he said, you know, I thought we had another 5 years before another one of these. Why do they keep happening so fast and why don't people learn? And I think, you know, that's going to be the big question we're going to be asking ourselves is why do we not understand how fundamentally risky a bank is? You know, we think of banks as safe. It's actually an important part of how banking works is that they project safety. You know, they always used to build banks to look like Roman temples so that they would look like they were very safe. But the reason we do that and we feel safe is because they're actually considerably riskier than putting your money in a money market fund that's backed by T-bills. They're actually doing something risky, and they have to be watched and watched quite carefully.
But they're doing something essential. What? Let's not forget about that. Without fractional reserve banking, I'm not going to get into details about what that means. Please look it up on Google. And without credit creation, which is something we do understand, the transformation of liabilities, i.e. deposits, into assets, i.e. loans, we would not have the economy that we have. You couldn't take a dollar for dollar. You need $1 of liabilities effectively transformed into $10 of assets.
Because it creates that
velocity of money in addition to economic growth and opportunity. If you couldn't borrow to invest in your company, you know, your hands would be severely tied. You wouldn't, you, all of these things that that individuals and even and small businesses need. So many of those things would be effectively unavailable to
them. Can I quote Eric here? Which second graph of his story. That's why when a bank fails, it's so essential to figure out what happened and ensure the same mistakes won't be made again. That's why we did this. And that's why we put it on the cover. And that's why we'll be talking about it, I think, for you know, hopefully a little while longer. And to that end, I do think that the repercussions of this are still playing out. And that's why also we haven't talked about the second piece of this package, which is worth mentioning. But it's also why Jamie Dimon was in D.C. yesterday talking with Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen to make sure that, you know, this $30 billion that ended up in First Republic could happen, right? And that actually, you know, it shows how much attention there is on this stuff. And, you know, of course, you'd call in the guy from the financial crisis to make sure that everything goes smoothly.
Eric, I also wonder if you sort of zoom out and look at it from a macro level. Was there a bubble in venture capital after a decade of low interest rates that just popped
Now, is the golden age of the quote-unquote founder over after this?
I just got about 20
Well, that's
seconds.
An excellent question. I think you can only call a bubble after it's actually happened and the dust settles, and I don't think we're quite there yet. We're not there where we can look back and say it was a bubble. There's no question there was way too much liquidity. There probably still is. We said it the other day, Carol.
Yep.
Jay Powell secretly might be not glad, but boy, a bank collapse sure does help to tighten financial conditions and make it easier to get a rein on inflation.
No, it's a really good point, right? Because you've got to look at this all, the big picture here.
Probably not his preferred
Stop
way
smiling,
to tighten.
Stop smiling, you guys. All right, we got to run. Pat Regnier, Markets and Finance Editor at Bloomberg Business Week, Editor-at-Large Eric Schatzker at Bloomberg News, and Joel Weber, Editor at Bloomberg Business Week. Folks, it's a finance takeover. It's the cover. It's a must read for the weekend. This is Bloomberg Radio.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just under 18 minutes left in today's trading session. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week on this Thursday. Carol Masser along with Mike Regan. Let's get to it with our guests. Great to have back with us Vance Howard. He's CEO and Portfolio Manager at Howard Capital Management. They're a registered investment advisor, roughly $5 billion in assets under management. They've got mutual funds, ETFs, growth tactics, income, dividend, lots going on. So let's talk about strategy and news and the markets with Vance. Good to have you back. How are you?
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So is it great to be back in this environment?
It's always wonderful to be here with you, Kim.
Well, talk to us about this environment because, you know, day to day, the sentiment seems to change. We've got a rally underway in stocks. We've had some crazy treasury action, quite a move from peak to trough, if you will, right, over the last week. If you look at that two-year note, how do you see the market environment and the opportunities in it?
You know, Carol, you and I, Mike, were talking a minute ago about the 08 crash, and a lot of people maybe don't weren't around for that, or they don't remember how frightening that was when you went to bed at night and, you know, Bear Stearns was at 38, 40 bucks a share, woke up the next day, they were 75 cents.
Right. And for those of us covering it, we didn't even go to sleep because the news headlines just kept coming.
It just kept coming, and it was unbelievably amazing, and it was frightening. And that was probably the closest we've come in my in my age anyway, for a complete meltdown like the 29 crash.
Is this that?
No, I don't think this is that. But I got to tell you, whenever they say a bank has failed, it gets my attention really, really quick, because that's the worst that you can have in a financial crisis. In a financial crisis like this, garden variety bear markets, they come, they go. But when banks implode, you've got a serious problem. It's like, that's when, hey, Houston, you got a problem. So wake up.
Yeah, and Vance, it's easy, I think, to get lulled into a sense of complacency when you look at the market reaction to this news. S&P up 1.9%, but this isn't over, I feel like. I mean, are we going to be talking about a different bank tomorrow, next week, and the week after?
And I think that's what all managers are looking at right now, is where's the real risk here? We de-risked not because the HCM buy loan, which is our proprietary indicator, went negative, because it really came close to turning negative, but it's just right there on the cusp. We de-risked because it hit our stop losses for a bunch of positions that
when
we had.
When did you de-risk?
We de-risked on Friday and Monday and Tuesday.
Okay.
And so
in
that
the
took
thick
us
of
out
it.
Of a lot of mar- out of a lot of the, out of a lot of the market there. So we're in about 35 to 40% cash right now out of the $5 billion that we trade.
And I always want to know, is that no, that's not normal. normal for you guys.
It is not normal. Only when the HCM buy line, it stops. It just hit, it triggered stops that we had in, and we're glad that we had them. But it, this market's going to be incredibly volatile. You feel like you're running in quicksand right now, and you're not sure which way to go, right, left, or north or south.
Vance, I'm kind of a market nerd, so when I hear proprietary indicator, my ears perk up. Could you tell some of the inputs of the HCM buy line indicator?
The HCM buy line is a lot less complicated than people think. It's actually a number of indexes that are averaged together to create our own proprietary index, and then our moving average is our own mathematical equation to a moving average.
Equity or various asset classes.
Equities, okay. All equities, because that's really what we're looking at. So we're not really thinking about bonds as far as investing in stocks. So, but that did stay positive. But Mike, another thing that's very disturbing is the 200-day moving average on the S&P went negative. It closed below that. Now, I think it might close back above there today. So that would be a positive sign. I know a lot of managers are looking at that. A lot of individuals are looking at that. We do hope that it closes above there. But when banks start to come unwound, that's not good.
All right, so cash is the place you would tell everybody to go right now, or no? I mean, you still have equity exposure.
We do. We've got about 60%. We were buying BIL, which is bill. It's 1 to 3 month treasuries, and I think iShares has got
that's
that. So really, it's liquid. It's very fluid, and we're making a decent rate of return. But I tell you what, we've got to watch out for is what is the Fed going to do? And everybody seems to think that the Fed's mandate is to crush inflation. The Fed's mandate is to create stability in our markets. That's key one. Yeah. Well, did the Fed create this problem? Did the Fed create instability in our markets by raising rates too far, too fast that nobody could keep up?
Or the Fed create problems by keeping it low for too long?
That one too. And there's a case on both sides of the equation. But it needs to be monitored on both sides of that equation, too much, too fast, or too low for too long. Either way, they've got to get a handle on this. And because like you said, Mike, when you have treasuries that kill a bank, that's weird.
That's not something
weird.
I think it doesn't.
It's not on my bingo card.
I don't think it gets talked about enough, right, Mike? Like, we always talk about treasuries. That's your safe haven. That's where you go. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. Well, and of course, in this case, it was, what part of the treasury curve were you invested in? Right. They were clearly too far on the long end, but, not even the type of thing that's in a bank stress test, typically.
Yeah, that's right. And, and you look at what happened there with SVB. But another thing, too, when you look at that bank, they were doing loans they probably shouldn't have done. They're playing venture capitalist with bank money.
Yeah.
And I don't really agree with that either. They're the 16th largest bank in the country.
I know. Their assets ballooned.
They did. And so you have to ask yourself, why did they balloon? And that's the reason what they were doing was what they probably shouldn't have been doing.
Vance, you talk about your HCM buy line, your proprietary indicator. What you're seeing in that indicator, is it similar to what, I don't know how long that indicator's been around for you guys, but take us back to some other kind of crisis moments or critical junctures in the trade. Have you seen a similar move?
We've had the HCM buy line since the mid-90s, and of course we've worked on it and tried to make it better and better and better, but it called the 08 crash really, really well. It pulled us out the second week of January of 08, and we really sat and catched pretty much the whole year. And as a trend indicator, it can get whipsawed occasionally.
As we went into the pandemic?
It called it beautifully. And I made more money in the pandemic than any other year I've ever made. I mean, we pulled out almost 60% of cash. We were 40% invested at the bottom. We came back in on March 24th of that same year. The bear market only lasted 6 weeks.
Of 2020?
Yeah. And so we caught that whole uptrend with 60% of our cash and actually made a fortune. And so it really panned out pretty well for us.
Vance, what's so funny is we're talking about all these risks out there, all this sour mood. I'm looking, the S&P still up 3% on the year. What would you need to see to get, double-fisted bullish towards stocks? Do we need like that capitulation where everything sells and the market just takes a steep dive?
Well, like I said, the reason we de-risked wasn't because the buy line went positive. When the buy line's positive, we like to buy stocks and own stocks and hold them for the longer term. We de-risked because it just hit stop losses. We'll be looking to get back in due to the fact that the buy line's positive. Now, it's not a very active indicator. I mean, I wish it'd never go negative, then I'd never have to de-risk, but that's not realistic. Look at 08, look at the pandemic, look at what happened in January of 2022.
Right.
And another thing, too, we got to look at, Mike and Carol, is you got to take the, I don't know what the market's going to do next week or next year. Nobody else does. I don't know if we're going to go into a recession. Nobody else does either. So with a good trend indicator, at least you know what the trend's doing.
Yeah.
That's a really good point, right? Because we all try to, but exactly. But if you have a better indication or idea of where the trend line is going, that can help maybe protect your assets and certainly your portfolio. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Don. Good to have you back with us. Vance Howard, Chief Executive Officer, Portfolio Manager at Howard Capital Management, here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.